My name's Tammy, and I'm an addict, recovering crack addict, to be more specific. So I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what my life is like today. So, you know, I'm not one of those people that maybe have a reason why my life was so horrible growing up that, you know, I had to become an addict, right? My parents are still married to this day for 58 years. I had a pretty good childhood. You know, I started doing the stuff like normal teenage girls do, you know, hanging out, going to parties I shouldn't be going to. And I don't know, by hearing some people's stories, I was kind of late bloomer. I started smoking weed when I was 14, drinking beer about the same age. And then I graduated from high school barely because I was stoned and couldn't make it to first period in time. And so I had to write a 10-page report just to be able to walk with my class. I was 18 years old and met my first husband. And, you know, I was doing the bar scene, the weed and all that. And let me shut this window real quick. Sorry. It was kind of loud in the background, I'm sure. So, you know, I went to my later ex-brother, my brother-in-law's birthday party, right? And he was drunk all day and he was passed out, right? And the party was going on and you know, we had the weed in the living room and we had the keg in the garage but everybody kept going to this bedroom, you know, and the curious person that I am, right? I'm like, what the hell is going on in there? So I walked in there at the moment that I seen them put a needle in my brother-in-law's arm and he like rose from the dead because he's passed out drunk and he just rose from the dead. And it was crystal meth, you know? And I was like, I want some of that. And I wasn't willing to put a needle in my arm at the time, but I did some crystal and it was the old school. I'm older, so it was the old school meth. And it became part of my every weekend routine, right? And I didn't think that meth was a problem for me. I mean, I held a job, but the bills might have suffered a little bit. The lights never got cut off. The rent got paid on time. I had a job. You know, I was present. I thought really well for my kids, you know. And, well, at the time, I hadn't had my kids, but, you know, it lingered into after having kids. But, you know, I thought I was present. I thought I was doing okay. And even when I got pregnant with my daughter, I stopped, right? I didn't stop the weed because, you know, that did help with the nausea during my pregnancy. So I didn't stop the weed, but I did stop the meth. And then, you know, my kids are real close to age, same age. They're 16 months apart. And, you know, I end up marrying my kids' father. I can't tell you when we got married, but I can sure tell you when we got divorced. You know, we were married less than a year. We were together 5 years. And see, I'm that person that I needed something to make me feel different about myself from a very young age. I mean, I remember waking up very young and crawling in mama's bed. And so just so she'd rub my stomach, you know, I'd fake an upset stomach just to get something to make me feel different, you know, and it went into, you know, men, you know, the men always was what I was after. And then of course the drugs and, anything to make me feel different than how I was feeling. I did not feel okay with myself ever, you know, So, you know, I married my first husband, and you know, he told me that he was getting divorced. But when I found out that he wasn't getting divorced, it didn't stop me from being with him, right? Him and his ex-wife had a child in January of 1985, and we had our daughter in October of 1985. So, you know, we end up getting divorced, and, you know, I was that person, like I said, that just because they were married, it didn't keep me from being with them. You know, I didn't intentionally go after married men, but I felt like, hey, if a married man wanted to be with me, I must be one hell of a woman, right? And so then my first husband got divorced, and I immediately got involved with this guy who was, guess what, married, you know. And at that time, I was still doing the meth and the beer and whatever other kind of alcohol I could do. And I got involved with that guy, this guy, and we... You know, I'm not a manipulator, too. I am a good manipulator. He let me know that he wasn't ready for a permanent relationship, but I knew better than him. I'm going to, like, don't you know who I am? I'm a great person. And so before he knew it, I moved in, and then, the kids were pretty much with my mom and dad. And then before he knew it, the kids are moved in, and he's got a ready-made family. See, don't you know? That's what you really needed, wanted, you know? And so, things lasted about 3 years with him. And then, I got with my second husband, and he was in recovery, and I didn't know what that meant, you know? I was going to Al-Anon for him, you know, cause I'm that chameleon. I'll blend into whatever needs to be done. And so I was going to Al-Anon with him. And then, I thought maybe I should go to AA. But he was 14 months sober, and he was going to, like a detox meeting to share his experience, strength, and hope. And then he was going to his own personal meeting afterwards, and he never made it to either one. He did crack cocaine, and that's where he ended up at the crack house. And so for a month after that, you know, and all I needed to do was say, well, come on, we'll figure it out. It'll be okay. I'm here to support you, right? And for about a month after that, he was going to the crack house every Friday night and spending all the money, and he was making really good money. And I didn't get it, right? So, I'm bitching and complaining. And so what's a good addict do? The next Friday night, he went to the crack house, got three rocks and brought them home and laid them on the dresser and said, do you want to try them? And I've done other drugs, like I said. So what do I say? Well, of course I do. I want to try it. I never thought about the minimum, the financial impact that it was having on us of all the money being spent. You know, I thought, well, he's going to be home with me instead of being at the crack house all night long. And I did. And I was one of the very unfortunate ones. From the time I hit crack cocaine, my life immediately spiraled down. Immediately. I went from a duplex, living across the street from my kids' elementary, working for the state. I could send my kids off to school, pat them on the little bottom, give them a little kiss, send them off to school, and be off work and home by the time they got home from school. Life was good, right? Until crack cocaine came into my life, and everything went downhill from there. We had rented out the car to the dope man several times. We lost our place, of course. I resigned from the state. We ended up moving in with my grandmother. And, I would make up every excuse there was to go to the dope house. Like Frank, we'd get home, and Frank was my second husband's name, and we'd get home and, want to go get some crack, and, then we had to run to the store to get something for supper, and in the meantime, run by the dope man. smoke the dope before we got home and then try to cook supper. I don't know about y'all, but if you ever try to cook food while you're high on dope, it's not a pleasant time, right? And so, in the meantime, my cousin, who also lived with my grandmother, he had been molested by his father. And the reason I bring that up is because it's been known that little boys who molest tend to molest. And I would leave my kids with my cousin while I went and got some crack. And ultimately what happened is my daughter ended up getting molested by my cousin. So we, of course, moved out. My cousin went to jail. And my mom and dad was able to get us into a duplex. And, you know, Frank worked for, he was an AC installer. And he made pretty good money. And he was the foreman of this job. And, you know, he would get these rows and rows and rows of copper tubing, right? And he would steal them from the job and bring them home. And, at first he'd steal them from the job and take them to the recycling place, you know, like almost every night. And finally the recycling guy said, "They did. I know what you're doing. So you need to at least, you know, break them up or something." So then he'd bring them home and, every night we'd break them down and everything. And so we could get the money. Because copper brings in pretty good money. That's a good little hit of dope, you know. And in the meantime, you know, my kids, they were with me. We were in and out of, before we got the duplex, we were in and out of hotels. And Frank would get the money from the recycling, go buy like McDonald's and get the kids something to eat almost every night, you know, and is what my kids ate. We'd buy a package of lunch meat, whatever, something cheap, a pastry or whatever for the kids to eat breakfast. And then, you know, every night it was the same routine, right? So my kids weren't being fed properly. They definitely, I wasn't mentally present, you know. And so mom and dad, I'm sorry, dogs are barking. Mom and dad came to me and said, "Hey, why don't you let us take care of the kids until you get your shit together?" And we just didn't know it was going to take me 16 years to do that, right? And so, and of course, you know, that was perfect for me. You know, mom, the babies were safe, and they were about 6 and 7 by this time, 7, 8, something like that. The kids were safe, and you know, I had all the time in the world to get high, you know, and it was the hardest job I've ever had in my life. You know, it was a 24/7 job. And so, you know, cause my kids have been to the dope house. My kids have been, you know, back and forth to the dope dealer and continue to ask, "Where are we going tonight?" "Well, daddy's got to go get a tool." You know, it's always something, right? I could think of that lie in a heartbeat. One time we were hanging out at a dope house and the kids would be upstairs playing and the adults would be in the garage smoking dope. And the next night we were going to go, but we didn't. And the following night when we went, they had been raided the night before. So it's only by the grace of God that CPS has not had to, that did not step in my life, you know, and that mom and dad did, because they sure should have, you know. So, you know, my crack addiction went from, it was never good. You know, I've heard people's stories say, "I did the dope till it didn't work anymore," right? Well, crack cocaine never worked for me. It never did. I never enjoyed it. I mean, I guess, you know, how they talk about that first high and we keep chasing it. That happened for me, but it was never a good time, ever. And so, you know, one of the programs they talk about, jails, institutions, or death, right? And I've done the the jail, and I've done institutions. And fortunately, I never had to experience the death or overdose. But, you know, my grandmother one time, like at this point, I'm living on the street, right? I end up going, sorry, but I missed a big part. So Frank, who my second husband, he had Hep C. He did the interferon, kept drinking. And on our second year anniversary, he was diagnosed with 8 tumors on his liver. So he liked one day making it 9 months, right? And perfect excuse for a crack addict to smoke crack. And so it got even worse after that. I was prostituting. I've been to jail, state jail 3 times, 2 times for dope, and the last one for enhanced prostitution. I don't know about y'all, but I don't know anybody that goes to prison for enhanced prostitution. And even that didn't stop me, you know? It talks about in the big book, giving sufficient reason, right? That should have been a pretty good damn reason to stop doing dope. I seen a lady die of a heat stroke in prison because it was so hot. And I meant, every time I went to prison, I meant it when I said, I'm done. I'm done. And I meant it from the bottom of my heart, but I just didn't do anything to do different, right? I mean, earlier in my story, I talked about going to Al-Anon and AA, and, you know, I tried a sponsor, and I was going to smoke crack one night, and I tried to call her, and she didn't answer, so I'm like, okay, let's go. So, off to the races again. And so, my thinking is like completely miswired, you know. One of the times I went to prison, my daughter's 18 years old, and she writes me. She calls me. No, you don't get phone calls in prison. She writes me a letter and gives me a what for. I'm 18 years old. I got a job. I got a car. I have my own apartment. And she had every right to do that, right? And my son's the type that he kind of holds it in, you know, and then he blows up. But my daughter, she's very outspoken. She has actually worked for Austin Recovery, which is a miracle on its own. I'll get to that a little later. But so in and out of prison, in and out, same old thing. And so what happened? What happened was I was sitting on a bed, and I don't, you know, them big dressers, like it's got 6 drawers or whatever, and it's got that really real pretty mirror. I was sitting on the bed, and my profile was like in the mirror. You know, I seen out of the corner of my eye, and I had to take a second look because I didn't recognize the person that was in the mirror. You know, at this time, you know, I'm in my own place. I'm on disability because of all my health problems. And I got my own place. My mom's my payee because I can't handle my money at that time, you know, when I first became on disability because I was doing dope at the time. But so I'm in my own place, and I look in the mirror, and I don't even recognize myself. And I'm like, I got to do something. Something had to happen, you know. And it, you know, it talks about hitting that bottom, you know, and it wasn't about, because I lived on the street for 10 years, under the bridge, on 6th Street, you know, around 6th Street. So it wasn't about the material things, right? It wasn't that
you know, I had the place to live. I had a place to take a shower. I had food. You know, I mean, most of it was from the pantry because, you know, I was using my money to do dope. But I had those material things. But it was the internal, right? It was the internal pain that I had that I wanted a new life. And so I went to this meeting in AA, and I got me a sponsor. And the one lady I'd asked that I'd tried to call that night, and she didn't answer. I asked her. Every time I tried to get sober, I'd asked her. And we ended up being really good friends. And she finally had to say, Tammy, you know what? I love you, and I really want you to make it, but I don't think it's going to be a good idea for me and you to work together because, you know, we're too close, right? And I needed someone to call me on my shit. And so I went to this Big Book experience, and it was a workshop, right, about the Big Book. And I thought I was going to a convention where everybody's having a good time and just hanging out. And no, it was a Big Book study, but it was amazing. And I was 2 months sober, and I remember crying through the whole thing. And I got a scholarship. So when you get a scholarship, then they ask you to, you know, during the mealtime, like serve food or, you know, put the supplies out and all that stuff, right? And I was so willing to do it. I was just so grateful. But when I was 10 days sober, I was sitting at my house, and I had my large print Big Book, and I smoked crack in my bedroom in the past, so I wouldn't sleep in my bedroom. And so I was in the living room reading my Big Book, and I hear a knock on the door, and this girl knocks on the door, and I open the door, and it was one of them, I don't know anybody like this, but this person, but she was one of them crackheads that could, like, balls to the wall all weekend long, but Sunday about 6, she's like, okay, I'll see you next time. I'm like, what? But she came knocking at my door, and she was kind of swaying back and forth, you know? So I knew she had been drinking, and I just immediately said, you know what? I'm not doing anything. And so she just kind of walked on in, and she sat on my couch, and she asked me questions like, is your son here? And I'm like, well, yeah, my son's here. But of course, my son being in the house, that was grown. He was grown at the time. It never kept me from doing crack in the house, you know? And I told her, yeah. And I told her, I said, I don't have a pipe, and I don't have a can, and I'm not going to make a pipe out of the foil. You know, I'm not doing any of that. I don't smoke crack cocaine. And at 10 days sober, you know, as soon as that came out of my mouth, I turned around and looked like, who in the hell said that? Because she had told me, she's like, we don't have to go get it. I got it right here in my mouth. I mean, it was 2 feet from me, you know, and who in the hell says that? I don't say that. I don't say, you got it in your mouth? Oh, no, I'm done. I'm not going to smoke any more crack. What Tammy does is, oh, hell, screw it. I'll smoke it tonight, and I'll get sober again tomorrow, right? But God, I mean, it just came out of my mouth that quick, you know, and I told her I don't smoke crack anymore, and she walked out, right? And I remember just falling to my knees and crying because I knew that night I never had to smoke crack cocaine again. I knew that, you know, I just felt it. As long as I keep doing what I'm being taught to do, because remember, I was only about 2 months sober at the time, then I have a chance, right? And so I was very easy to work. I was very eager to work the steps because I wanted to give back so bad, you know, and we have to give back. You know, we have to give what was so freely given to us to keep this deal. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, you know, I have to do this. And so I met with my sponsor every week. I got through the 12 steps. I immediately started sponsoring. You know, something else that's important to me is service work. Service work is very important to me. I was 4 months old. 4 months sober and started going to H&I, hospital and institutions, where I carried the message to the addict who still suffers, right? And my sponsor, I had a good sponsor. She got me into it. You know, I've done lots of service work with Abe. You know, I am an alumni. But where I made a mistake was I probably went to Austin Recovery, I don't know, maybe 2005, 4, something like that. But I got out. I commenced. I got out. I never went to a meeting. I never got a sponsor. I never tried to do anything, right? And ultimately what happened is I relapsed the course. I was about 5 months sober, and I was going to volunteer at Austin Recovery. And I remember pulling up in the parking lot, and I'm thinking, what in the hell are you thinking that you're going to go in there and work for free and not get paid for it? I mean, it's like, you're out of your mind. Who does that? And so, I was kind of regretting it, and I went on in there because I said I'd be there, and I said, well, I'm going to do this day and not go back. You know, I said, I'd be here today. And I went in there, and the volunteer work I did is I would call people that had gotten out of Austin Recovery. And I, you know, whether they were 30, 60, 90 days. And I say, hey, how you doing? And the sad thing was a lot of people, like the family member, would answer and say that they're not doing too good. Because here's the deal. If I don't get out and out of treatment and do what I'm supposed to do, I'm going to go back out. If I'm the real deal, I'm going to go back out, right? And my experience showed it, I did. And the fact is that a lot of people don't make it after treatment. And some don't ever have the opportunity to come back in because they OD. And so anyway, I'm calling these people and I'm hearing the sad stuff, but then I'm hearing those ones, oh, I'm doing great. I got 2 sponsors, whatever, right? I'm doing great. Life is good. I got a really good job. I'm seeing my kids, all that. And I remember going out to the car. So you got to remember, I'm sensitive, but, and I numbed my emotions for so long doing crack cocaine that I've been crying ever since I've been sober, right? Got sober. So I go out to the car and I just start crying, thanking God, you know, that he allowed me to be a service like that to the place that did start the healing. I just chose not to take what they gave me, right? And I kept doing that. I kept going back and volunteering and working for free, right? But it wasn't work. It was beautiful. Until I ended up going to work for Austin Recovery at Cross Park. So I worked in the office doing the insurance. So, you know, I continue to sponsor. At 6 months sober, so I couldn't shoot dope that much because I'm a real bad diabetic. I have a lot of health problems due to my addiction, and I had really bad veins, so I couldn't shoot dope but a couple of times, you know. And I'm 6 months sober, and I got help see and it's active. And I got to do this really bad medicine called interferon that makes you sicker and dog. It's like chemo. And because of my other conditions, it made me even sicker. And I called this girl who was also an alumni who I knew had taken the interferon. And I said, I have to take interferon. I'm crying and stuff. And she said, God's got a plan. And I didn't want to hear that. I wasn't ready to hear that. And my response was, I got sober for this. This is what I got sober for. But, you know, God had a plan. So I did the interferon. I had to do 2 rounds, and I'm non-detectable. And 8 years ago this month, God's plan was, I got sober, then I did the interferon. Because in 2013, because of all the damage I did to my kidneys and my body, I had to have a kidney transplant. And that daughter that I left with mom and dad, that I left with my cousin who ended up molesting her, that daughter is the one who gave me a kidney, you know, 8 years ago. that same daughter, I've taken her to H&I places with me, and asked her would she like to give, you know, a little bit of, would she like to speak on, you know, being about the family after, and she said, yeah. She said, you wouldn't think that I could trust my mom, but today she's my very best friend. And she says, thank you. I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous. And she says, thank you, Cocaine Anonymous, for giving me my mama back. And I told you she also worked at Austin Recovery at Cross Park. And another location that was out, used to be out on Slaughter Lane. But you would think that, you know, because what she experienced, her and her brother experienced during my addiction, that she would have no tolerance whatsoever for addicts. But she loves us. She knows that, you know, it's not, has not, she realizes it has nothing to do with how much I loved her or her brother. It had to do with this is a disease, right? And actually, she had trouble setting boundaries, you know, with the clients. So, but she has a passion for the addict, you know, and I'm very proud of her for that. Because she could be bitter and everything. And the son, I told you about the, you know, he holds it in, you know, for 3 years of my sobriety, my son, we'd get into a little argument, like, you know, people do. And he'd say, you didn't raise me. My grandparents had to raise me because you're smoking crack cocaine. And so finally, I'd already made my amends to my kids, but, you know, he had that anger and rightly so, and he didn't know what to do with it. And I told him, I said, son, you're right. And there's nothing I can do to change that. But I'm moving forward, and I would love for you to be on this journey with me. And to this day, 9 years later, he still isn't, he's never thrown it in my face again about me not raising him. You know, so I have a beautiful relationship with my family, my kids. I'm a grandmother of a 14-year-old who's going into high school. She was 18 months old when I got sober, so she has never or has any experience or memory of my addiction. When I tell my kids or any family member I'm going to be there, I'm there today. You know, I get to be a service. I love service work. I'm a service junkie. It's what helps keeps me sober. And a lot of people say, well, tell me with all your health issues, how do you look so damn happy? And the fact is, I caused all those health issues due to my alcohol and drug addiction. You know, I have an awesome man today that you know, isn't married. there's something different. You know, I have morals today. You know, and the awesome thing about recovery is, when the hand of the fellowship reaches out, I get to give back, right? Life isn't great all the time. Life happens. You know, people who aren't addicts deal with it. They have people that they lose, you know. But my worst day in sobriety is better than my best day in my addiction, right? We've heard that before. Every time Austin Recovery has ever asked me to speak, I speak. Because I know without them that I wouldn't be here where I'm at today. It, you know, it was nothing on Austin Recovery that I relapsed. And actually, I'm not just a one-timer at Austin Recovery. I'm a three-timer. So, third time's a charm, right? You know, I've been in all kinds of service work. I'm a delegate for Cocaine Anonymous, which means I go to a conference once a year and I get to give back and I get to bring information and I get to, you know, and the most beautiful thing I think in recovery is, when I'm working with a female and, you know, they walk into the rooms and our eyes are just dark. We're just dark. There's like no soul, right? We're just so dead. And as I'm working with that sponsee, and you know, I see as she grows in this that light bulb goes off, and she's really, you know, wanting this deal, and she wants a way of life. And it's like beautiful flowers, you know, that they're first they're closed and then they just open up, you know, and that's just so beautiful to me, you know. And the last couple of meetings I've been in, they've talked about a higher power, right? And I had an issue with that when I first came into the rooms. I was pissed off at God. Why did God give me this way, this life? Why did God make me an addict? Why this? Why that? Right? And I go to a meeting when I first got sober, and y'all be talking about higher power, God, or whatever your higher power is. And I would like go outside and smoke and then come back in when they give out key tags, right? Especially if I was getting one. And it talks about the big book about, you know, that we have to have a relationship with God, a relationship. Like, it's all fine and dandy going to church and being involved and all that. But in one of the stories in the big book, you know, they're talking about when, you know, you got to do this deal, and the guy's face, you know, kind of like, oh man, what am I going to do? Because I go to church and I still can't stay sober. It's not about the church. It's about the relationship with the higher power, you know, because left to my devices, if I don't turn my life over to God, left up to me, I'm going to smoke some crack cocaine and I'm going to mess stuff up. Even if I'm not smoking crack, I can be miserable and not be of use to anyone. About like on page 52, the bedevilments, I can't have a relationship. I can't be, I'm not any use to anyone. I can be that not using, you know. If I'm walking out the door, I'm dropping my keys and I'm not dropping my purse and the coffee cup fell to the floor, I have to stop and say, oh, God, I didn't invite you into my life today. I'm sorry. You know, when I'm agitated, I have to pause. I had to learn real quick that, that things aren't always going to go my way. And most likely my way is wrong, you know, like it talks about on page 60, how people, you know, the stage character and the actor, and if people just do what the hell I want them to do, everything would be fine. Well, that's just not the case, because if people did what I want them to do, me, then it probably wouldn't be the right thing, right? God is a big part of my recovery. It's the main part of my recovery. I believe, I know that God always has a plan. I may not know what the plan is, and I may not like what I'm going through, but I know if I trust in my higher power that, you know, when I get through this situation, it's going to be fine. I know that. Now, do I remember that all the time? Absolutely not. I'm human. I do not remember that all the time. So I think my time is just about up. And so I like to always end on a page in the big book. It's on page 276. It's a personal story called Keys of the Kingdom. And if you haven't read the personal stories, read some. It gives you some hope. But it gave me hope that, dang, by hearing what they said that their life was like, and now they're happy. What? So in the big book, it said the words, the last 15 years, but I haven't been sober. I've been sober 12 years. So I always put whatever amount of sobriety I have. So I say the last 12 years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I've had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments, because that's life. But also I've known a great deal of joy and a peace that is
the handmaiden of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people, I am truly related. First through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experience with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love. Without strings, without obligations, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic addict that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and never need return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved in return for a bottle or crack pot and a hangover. We have been given the keys of the kingdom. Thank you, y'all.
Thank you, Tammy.
Thank you, Tammy.
Amazing.